So, neuroscience has basically told us for decades that trauma leaves a permanent physical scar on the human brain.
Right? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the assumption has always been that it's hardwired.
Right. Like, once a really terrifying experience is encoded, and we're talking especially about life or death combat here, it's just locked in a vault forever.
Right. And the best you can really do is, manage the symptoms, maybe build up some coping mechanisms over time.
Exactly. You just kind of learn to live alongside the ghost. But today we are actually going to challenge that fundamental assumption.
Which is pretty exciting, honestly.
It really is. We are pulling from this fascinating stack of sources for this deep dive. We've got clinical research from trauma specialists like Bruce Ecker, these really groundbreaking neurobiology papers by Karim Nader and Joseph Ledoux, and maybe most importantly, this profoundly personal account by a writer named Clint Matheny.
Yeah, Matheny's account is it's incredible. He documented a case of severe 53-year-old combat PTSD that was completely cured.
By accident.
Literally by accident, yeah,
Yeah.
in just a matter of seconds.
Using exactly 35 words. I mean, welcome to this deep dive. Our mission today is to, well, obviously look at this deeply moving story, but more importantly, to decode the actual biological mechanics of how a half century of trauma can just, dissolve on a casual afternoon walk.
It's a remarkable case study, and it really forces us to rethink everything we thought we knew about memory. We're going to be analyzing an excerpt from Matheny's writings on emotional health, which details this unplanned psychological breakthrough that happened back in 1998.
Right.
Because the sheer mechanics of what happened in those few seconds on the pavement, it completely challenges the traditional psychiatric models of trauma retention. As the research will show us, the human brain just isn't the rigid, unchangeable hard drive we always assumed it was.
So let's set the stage a bit here, because the context of this specific trauma is staggering. We aren't talking about like a mild phobia or bad memory.
No, not at all.
Matheny introduces us to his Uncle Red. And back in 1998, Uncle Red was an 83-year-old United States Marine Corps veteran. And for 53 uninterrupted years, he had been suffering from just debilitating combat PTSD from his service in World War II.
Yeah, and more specifically, his trauma was rooted in his very last night in a foxhole on Iwo Jima.
Wow, Iwo Jima.
Right. And the historical documentation on the sheer brutality of that battle is just overwhelming. But for Red, the combat didn't actually end when he rotated home in the fall of 1945. Objectively, sure, the threat had been neutralized. But subjectively, his nervous system was still actively fighting for survival every single day.
And the physical toll of that has to be devastating. I mean, the sources say the nightmares Red experienced were so visceral, so terrifying, that he actually refused to sleep in the same bedroom as his wife.
Yeah, he made that decision the moment he returned from the war in October 1945.
Because he was terrified he might accidentally hurt her in his sleep, right? While fighting off these invisible enemies. I just want you listening to this to really sit with that for a second. 53 years of sleeping in a separate room from your spouse. I mean, think about the physiological wear and tear. That is half a century of just flooding your system with cortisol and adrenaline every single time the sun goes down.
It's exhausting just to think about. We often visualize trauma as this heavy backpack you carry around, but biologically it functions a lot more like a catastrophic autoimmune response, you know?
That's interesting. How so?
Well, your body's defense mechanisms become hypersensitized, so it starts violently attacking a harmless everyday stimulus, which in Red's case was just the simple act of falling asleep because the brain is operating on this outdated, corrupted survival code. The system is functioning exactly as it evolved to, right? It's trying to protect him from a lethal threat. The tragedy is just that the brain cannot distinguish between a memory of 1945 and the actual reality of 1998.
Which brings us to the setup for this incredible accidental intervention. So Clint drives out to visit his aunt and uncle for lunch. Uncle Red is actually recovering from bypass heart surgery at the time, so the plan is just to take a gentle neighborhood walk, just to help with his physical rehab.
Right, a totally normal afternoon.
Exactly. But while Red is in his room putting on his walking shoes, his wife, Clint's aunt, pulls Clint aside for this private conversation.
She's essentially asking for an intervention here.
Yeah. She pleads with Clint to encourage Red to go seek psychological help from the Veterans Administration.
And her motivation is just heartbreakingly simple, too. She knows they're in their twilight years, and her only desire is to share their remaining time together in the same room. She just wants the separation to end.
Yeah, she wants her husband back. And Clint is obviously pretty hesitant about this. I mean, bringing up the VA to a man who has kept his trauma under a 53-year lockdown, that is an incredibly volatile move.
Highly risky, yeah.
But he promises his aunt he'll try, you know, if a natural opening presents itself. So they head out on this walk. And like we said, it's a completely mundane afternoon in a quiet neighborhood. But as they pass this large, white colonial house, Uncle Red suddenly just shatters the silence with this really jarring observation.
Yeah, this part is intense.
He points to the house and he says, they must have cleaned Mr. Smith's blood and brains off the wall behind that rocking chair this morning.
I mean, a statement like that just instantly shifts the entire atmosphere.
Totally. And Clint finds out that the neighbor, Mr. Smith, had actually shot himself in that rocking chair just a week prior.
Right. And Clint asks a really specific question here, which is key. He asks if anyone knew what Mr. Smith's mental state had been like leading up to the suicide.
And Uncle Red replies, he was like a lot of us. We went to war and came home forgetting we had a childhood.
That phrase is just, it's a devastating articulation of complex psychological trauma.
Forgetting we had a childhood.
Yes. It points to the absolute severing of the self. The innocent person who existed before the trauma is just completely disconnected from the survivor who exists after it. And for Clint, this observation really signaled the opening he promised his aunt he would look for.
So Clint takes the shot. He gently suggests that Red might benefit from talking to a professional at the VA. And Red's reaction is just explosive.
Oh, he becomes instantly enraged.
Yeah, his face turns completely red. He invades Clint's personal space, like gets right up in his face. And he shouts out of what is clearly decades of agonizing survivor's guilt. He screams, I should have died that night in the foxhole.
At this moment, Red is no longer walking down a suburban street in 1998.
He's gone.
Completely. He is experiencing a full neurobiological flashback. His amygdala has completely hijacked his prefrontal cortex. He's fully back in that foxhole on Iwo Jima.
And here is where Clint makes a move that defies every single rule of conflict resolution. He doesn't back down. He doesn't, like, offer sympathy or try to calm him down. He raises his own voice to match Red's absolute fury. And he fires back exactly 35 words.
Right.
He shouts, if you can feel your feet, you are alive. Most of your buddies would be dead from old age by now. You owe it to your wife to sleep in her bed before you die.
35 incredibly precise words.
I mean, I am genuinely struggling to understand how this didn't end in a physical altercation. Because if you ask any psychologist, yelling aggressively at a deeply traumatized combat veteran who's in the middle of a severe flashback, that seems reckless, like bordering on actually dangerous.
Oh, absolutely.
You're confronting a man who just confessed he should have died. And you scream back at him about his feet and his marital obligations. Like, why didn't Red just punch him?
Well, on paper, it violates every conventional guideline of emotional de-escalation, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're always taught to lower your voice, give them space, and calmly try to orient the person.
Right. Speak softly.
Yeah, exactly. But the intensity of Clint's reaction is actually the vital catalyst for what happens next. He didn't offer a polite suggestion. He created a high-speed collision between Red's reactivated past trauma and an inescapable, undeniable present reality.
Okay, but in the immediate aftermath, it really felt like a disaster. Red just stands there, staring silently at his nephew. Then he literally turns on his heel and walks all the way home without uttering a single syllable.
Total silence.
Yeah, and when they finally arrive at the driveway, Clint's aunt is waiting. She asks if they talked about the VA. Clint admits they did, but tells her it didn't go well. Red just walks straight into the house, completely ignoring Clint. And Clint drives home convinced he has permanently ruined his relationship with his favorite uncle.
And, it, you know, from a purely behavioral standpoint, withdrawal and silence after an explosive outburst are almost universally interpreted as anger, right?
Yeah.
Or at least a deepening of those defensive walls. So Clint's assumption of failure is completely logical.
Totally logical. But the hidden reality of those 35 words is just astounding. So fast forward an entire year. Clint's aunt receives this tragic cancer diagnosis. And during a private phone call while Red is out of the house, she takes the time to thank Clint for what he did for Red on that walk.
And Clint is just baffled.
Right. He's like, what are you talking about? I ruined everything.
But the revelation she shares completely flips the narrative of that entire afternoon.
She tells Clint that on the exact day of that explosive argument, the day Clint thought he destroyed their relationship, Uncle Red came home in silence, moved all his personal belongings back into her bedroom, and took the heavy padlock she had used to lock him in every night for 53 years.
Wow.
He took that padlock and he secured his old bedroom door from the outside.
It is an incredibly potent physical action. Locking the empty room from the outside signals a definitive end to an era.
And it wasn't just like a symbolic gesture either. He never experienced those terrifying nocturnal episodes again, not a single one.
That's amazing.
For the remaining 2 years of his wife's life, they slept peacefully in the same bed every single night. And the healing rippled outward too. A year after she passed, Red traveled to Orlando with his grandson for his very first USMC 5th Marine Division reunion.
He finally went.
He finally went. He let himself be embraced by the surviving members of his platoon, and he lived in peace until he passed away in 2002.
The padlock is just such a powerful metaphor for locking the trauma away instead of being locked away by the trauma. But, you know, biologically speaking, what happened in his brain was actually the exact opposite of locking something away.
What do you mean?
The memory vault was actually blown wide open. Red's silence on that walk home wasn't anger. It was profound, resource-heavy internal processing.
Okay, this is where I really need us to dig deep into the science, because I am trying to wrap my head around how a 53-year-old memory can just be permanently altered in 30 seconds. Isn't trauma quite literally hardwired into the brain's architecture by that point? Like, how does it physically change?
Well, for a very long time, the scientific consensus completely agreed with your assumption. If you go back to early neuroscientists like Santiago Ramon y Cajal, the prevailing theory of memory was called consolidation.
Okay, consolidation.
Right. The idea was that when you experience something, your brain processes it, synthesizes new proteins to build synaptic connections, and saves the memory. Once it is saved or consolidated, it is permanent. You can recall it, look at it, put it back, but the underlying physical structure of the memory cannot be changed.
It's like writing something in wet cement, right? Once it dries, it's there forever. You can paint over it, maybe try to ignore it, but the groove is permanently set in the stone.
That was the bedrock of trauma therapy for decades. The belief was that you couldn't erase the cement groove. You could only build new, healthier neural pathways around it to sort of distract the brain.
Right, coping mechanisms.
Exactly. But in the late 1990s and early 2000s, researchers like Karim Nader and Joseph Ledoux began publishing these studies that upended this entire model.
Okay, so what did they actually find?
They discovered that memories are not permanent cement grooves. Every single time you retrieve a memory, especially a highly emotional one, the neural circuits actually become unstable.
Wait, really?
Yes. The synapses temporarily unglue. The memory becomes what we call labile, meaning it is vulnerable to alteration. In order for the brain to put the memory back into storage, it has to literally synthesize new proteins and rebuild the connection from scratch. This process is called memory reconsolidation.
Hold on. So remembering something actually destroys it temporarily. Like, the brain has to actively reconstruct the memory every single time you think about it just to keep it.
Yes. Yeah. And Nader proved this in animal models using a chemical called anisomycin, which stops protein synthesis. He would trigger a fear memory in a rat, immediately inject the protein blocker, and the fear memory would completely vanish.
Wow. Because the brain couldn't build the proteins to save it again.
Exactly. Because it couldn't rebuild it, the fear was erased.
Okay, but Clint Matheny didn't have a syringe full of experimental neurochemicals on that walk. He just yelled at his uncle.
Right. And that brings us to the clinical work of therapists like Bruce Ecker. Ecker and others realized that you don't actually need chemical inhibitors to block the memory from saving.
You don't.
No. Information can act as an inhibitor, provided it creates massive cognitive friction. When Clint yelled those 35 words, he accidentally executed the precise biological sequence required for memory reconsolidation.
Okay, let's break down that sequence. What actually happened in Red's brain on the pavement right then?
Well, the first requirement is lighting up the target memory. The emotional center of the brain has to be fully engaged. So when Red screamed, "I should have died that night in the foxhole," his synapses were ungluing. He wasn't just casually reminiscing about Iwo Jima. His brain was actively pulling the entire trauma network into a highly unstable labile state.
Okay, so the vault is open, the cement is suddenly wet again.
Exactly. The memory is suspended in working memory, waiting to be rebuilt and saved. This is the critical window. If Clint had just apologized and walked away, Red's brain would have resynthesized the proteins, saved the trauma exactly as it was, and the nightmare would have just continued that night.
But Clint introduces the contradiction. He yells, "If you can feel your feet, you are alive. Most of your buddies would be dead from old age by now."
And this creates the mismatch. This is the cognitive friction. The brain is now holding two intensely conflicting realities simultaneously.
Right.
Reality A is the raw, unglued emotional terror from 1945. I am in a foxhole, my friends are dying, and I am about to be killed. Reality B is the undeniable sensory input from 1998. I am an old man, my feet are on paved asphalt, and my friends died of natural causes decades ago.
But why doesn't the brain just reject reality B? I mean, if the trauma is so deeply entrenched, why doesn't Red just push Clint away and stay in the flashback?
Because Clint tied it to an immediate visceral sensory experience. Feel your feet. You cannot hallucinate away the physical sensation of gravity on the pavement when your attention is forcefully directed to it.
It anchors you.
Exactly. It acts as an anchor to the present. The brain is fundamentally an organ of prediction and survival. When it encounters absolute proof that its survival prediction, meaning I am in a foxhole about to die, is definitively false, it experiences a jarring prediction error.
So the brain essentially blue screens. It realizes the 1945 file is dangerously outdated because the 1998 physical evidence just totally contradicts it.
And because the memory is currently unglued, that jarring mismatch acts just like the chemical inhibitor in the rat studies. The new contradictory information chemically interrupts the reconsolidation of the old emotional charge.
That is wild.
The brain refuses to spend the metabolic energy to rebuild a fear pathway that has just been proven definitively false. The neural representation of the foxhole is updated with the emotional safety of the present day.
You know, the analogy I keep coming back to is how files work on a computer. Like, for 53 years, Red's memory of Iwo Jima was a read-only document. Every single night, his brain would open the file, read the horrifying contents, trigger the fight or flight response, and close the file without changing a single word.
That's a great way to look at it.
But when Clint matched his intensity and forced him to feel his feet on the ground, he forced that document into edit mode. He opened the file, typed a completely new ending, the reality that he survived, grew old, and has a wife waiting for him, and the brain just hit save. It permanently overwrote the original file.
The brilliance of this accidental intervention is that Clint didn't just argue with the past, right?
Mm-hmm.
He weaponized the present.
Mm-hmm.
He provided an experiential truth that the trauma simply could not coexist with, and the silence on the walk home. That was Red's brain rapidly restructuring its synaptic connections. The psychological allergy was neutralized.
I mean, this shifts our entire understanding of human resilience. It implies that the emotional truth of a memory is never set in stone. The things that dictate our behaviors, our fears, our limitations, they're fundamentally malleable.
Completely malleable.
You don't need to be dealing with half a century of combat trauma to find incredible hope in the mechanics of this story.
The broad application here is really profound. It suggests that our deepest internal roadblocks are maintained only because they haven't yet been confronted with the right contradictory experience.
Right.
It changes how we should view moments of intense friction in our daily lives. When we are confronted with a reality that shatters an internal narrative we hold about ourselves, it isn't an attack. It is a biological opportunity for the brain to reconsolidate and discard a survival strategy we simply no longer need.
And that brings us to a final thought for you to chew on as we wrap up today's deep dive. We've spent this time breaking down the biology of a mismatch during memory activation. We've seen how the terrifying reality of a 53-year-old war trauma was instantly overwritten simply by introducing a startling contradiction while the memory was wide open.
Yeah.
So I want you to turn that lens on your own life. Think about the limiting stories or the negative beliefs you are holding onto right now, the narratives that keep you locked in your own metaphorical separate bedroom. What if those stories aren't permanent life sentences written in cement? What if they are just waiting for a mismatch? Consider this: what deeply held limiting belief of yours might just be one surprising, perfectly timed disruption away from disappearing entirely.
The neural pathways are always listening.
Yeah.
The brain is always prepared to update the file, provided we give it the undeniable evidence it needs to let go.
It really makes you wonder how many heavy, invisible burdens we continue to carry simply because we haven't yet been forced to feel our own feet on the ground. We hope this deep dive gave you a completely new perspective on the architecture of memory and how we heal. Thanks for exploring it with us.